That means if you're going to say to your children, we had a neat trick in our house with three of them now. Well, two of them leave. We leave at 7:45, and the little girl leaves at 9 with her daddy. I'm cooking breakfast, of course, and I just didn't have time to go over this. Is your shirt buttoned? Is your belt buckled? Are your shoes tied? Have you brushed your teeth? So we sat down and we defined what getting dressed means. And we went over the list. Now, what does it mean to get dressed? It means to put on your underwear. Some of you remember, small children they don't always get that first. And then button all of your shirts and brush your teeth in whatever order. And then I say, now everybody say after me, what does getting dressed mean? And so we go back over this list. And so now getting dressed means all of it, so that we don't have to go back over that. I was talking about developing a rod in your spirit. So if your husband does not believe in using the rod, then in that example, you would have to, for however long it takes, weeks, months, you would have to train that child and stand right outside the door of his room and say, if he comes out with the shirt tail out, turn him around with the shoulders, say, go back in your room and tuck in your shirt tail. You are not dressed yet. Now, what does dressing mean? And go back over it, and it will be harder for you. It will be harder for you this way. It takes longer. It's harder. But you can do it. You can develop a rod in your spirit, a rod of authority. And you can do that if you understand that we are responsible for training our children. Now the question always comes, do you use other methods of discipline? And the answer is yes, I do. That doesn't mean it's right to do it that way. Usually other methods of discipline cause any one of a number of things. One young woman said, our little girl, we were all out in front the other day, and our little girl ran out in the street, and there was a car coming. And so I sent her to her room. And this was an beautiful example to me of using the rod and why not to use another method. Because in the instance of running out in front of a car, something like that, that child needs to learn the meaning of the word no. And what's more, they need to learn to respond quickly to the word no. And if you have a strong-willed toddler and you say no and they just go right on the direction they're going, then I really feel like it is your responsibility to train that child to stop when you say no, to keep him from the possibility of serious injury. So I said, a little girl, she was a little girl about 3 or something, and I said, she's not going to have time to stop and reason in her mind. I may have to go to my room if I run out in front of this car. But if she knows that no, not obeyed, means pain, then she will learn to stop quickly. The other reason is it usually puts something between you and the child. And the favorite example for this has been, you can't ride your bicycle for a week. And that bicycle is going to stay between you, your spirit, and the spirit of that child. And you're going to have to maintain that bitterness and that anger all week in the person of that bicycle. So these are the areas, I think, that are dangerous in not going ahead with the rod. And again, we're still going to get to some instructions on how you can maintain a good relationship with a child while still using a rod of correction. When I'm confronted with these two statements, number one, I tried using physical correction and it just did not work. And I know the use of a rod is working, but I still do not feel right about it. I feel, and very often there's a feeling of guilt and a feeling of discouragement about using the rod. Then I review these suggestions with them. Number one, communication. I think the use of the rod is not just if the child is not adequately informed about what's expected of him. And I use the example of driving to school with my 7-year-old son to the first grade. We were driving about the 3rd or 4th morning, and I said, well, I don't have to tell you what I had been saying, because halfway down Preston Road, he said, what does late mean? And I thought of the 3 years behind us when I had been saying, you're going to be late to the birthday party, you're going to be late to this, you're going to be late to that. And that word really, now my son is very creative, but he would foul me up with that question. Just he'd throw that out just to confuse me. But there are many times, children are a garden of misinformation and misunderstanding. And there are times when they do not understand. And also, you know, they take everything you say literally. They know, when you use an exaggeration, a gross exaggeration or an overstatement, they take that literally. And it distorts what you're trying to tell them to do. So they may not understand. So I say, number one, if you feel that the rod is not working or if it's not just, check first your communication. Are you sure they understand what you expect of them? And always instruct a child on his eye-to-eye level. Always get on an eye-to-eye level. And I find with a child who is really just erratic and undisciplined in his behavior and a mother who is at her wit's end, that often, very often, just getting on an eye-to-eye level with that child will really help the situation. Just get on his, just look him right in the eye and say, you must do as I tell you to do, and here is what I want you to do. And they will say, oh, all right. And again, you have to go back. They really do. I know you don't believe me, but you go home and try that tonight, and you're going to be amazed at the change in direction. And once again, it won't work then if you're at the sink the next minute, and you turn around over your shoulder and say, don't do that. You have to, training takes time. You have got to abandon your project for a while and go back to that child and say, on an eye-to-eye level, you may not do that. You may not do that. No, no. So instruct them on an eye-to-eye level. With little ones, have them say it back to you. Have them say back to you what you want. You'll be amazed to learn, number one, that your instructions are too complicated. And they'll try to say it back to you, and they can't even get their tongues around it. So you'll learn to simplify for their understanding. And you'll learn, number two, that they had a misunderstanding about what you told them to do. So instruct them on an eye-to-eye level and ask them to repeat the instructions so you can understand that they learn, that they know what you meant. Often, I think there is a time for discerning motives in disobedience. Now, right now, the world, I think, has got too much emphasis on discerning the motives and not enough on the disobedience. But there is a time to realize that you have been on the phone all day. And they need your attention. And they have learned. Remember yesterday I said reinforce good behavior and not bad behavior? They have learned that if they are bad enough, you'll hang up the phone. And remember the little boy I said on the telephone with his mother. He had the situation well in control. And he knew if he continued to scream, she would hang up. And they are very, very smart. So try to discern the motives for their disobedience. And again, in the notebook it says, again, spankings are an integral part of training. If you are not training the child, then the spanking will not be just. Do you see that? If you're not training the child. Now I ask you to check your environment. And the most important and significant thing here is how are your family manners? Do you know most of us are rude to our children, and especially our teenagers? We just are rude. And I'll say again, I'm really repeating myself these 2 days, but I think these things are important. When you are thinking about your teenage child, an 11, of course they're beginning to get to that age. Somebody asked me about an 11-year-old this morning, and I said the problem with him is he's about to be 12. And he's growing up, and he has sensitivities, very sensitive spirit. And so I say, talk to them as you would talk to me. Talk to them as you would talk to me. Appreciate the fact that they do not have their body and their soul in synchrony. We talked about that yesterday. I mean, the spirit and soul have not yet taken over control of the body yet. They're still erratic, and they don't act the way they want to act. But take into consideration that in the little spirit, in the soul, that they have very surprisingly adult reactions to things. And you cannot say embarrassing things to them and harsh things. And so I say to a parent, if you are having trouble communicating with your teenager, then think about what you think how I would react to the way you talk to them. And if that mother and I had gone shopping and she had said to me, "Don't act that way, you're being silly," I would have said, you know, from now on you go shopping by yourself because because you embarrass me and I'm not going to be your friend anymore. So you think about that. And many people like to say, "Susan, you're telling me to treat my 12-year-old like an adult and he is not an adult." And that's a deliberate misunderstanding because that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that they still have to be under the rules of your household. You still have the rights of a parent. But you have a responsibility then, as a parent, to understand that that child has adult sensitivities. And they do not want to be embarrassed. They do not want to be spoken to in an impolite fashion. Even little children were just rude to them. And sometimes if they don't have good manners, you can look and see that you forget to say thank you and please to them. And that you forget to quietly and carefully train them at home to say please and thank you and yes ma'am and no ma'am to you. And then when you get out in public, you say thank you to the lady, honey. And that's embarrassing. The time for that training is at home. Or you may say it to them in such a way that the person does not hear, the person to whom they're supposed to say thank you. Check your family manners. Check the manners between siblings. They need to learn that they have to respect the rights of privacy of their brothers and sisters. And again, with little ones, I have a lot of experience with little ones. And they just cannot be allowed to run rampant over their brothers and sisters' possessions and belongings. And you have to use some skill here in separating them and having a place where they can keep their things. I won't pursue that because there's plenty of secular literature on that subject and good literature. Check your environment. Do the children have time for quiet activities by themselves? This is a personal thing that I have, maybe. It's just a personal problem, maybe. But I was an only child, and I loved it. You know, I know a good thing when I see it. And I never had the resentment that some children have over being only children. I was an only child, and my mother worked all the time. And I had a lot of time by myself. And it was during that time that I became a meditator. And it was that meditation and that quiet activity, I think, that has contributed so much to the activities of my adult life and some of the abilities and capacities for concentration and interest in meditating and developing concepts and studying. And I think that a time for quiet is so important for little children when they're in a large family. They need to be separated from one another for a time and given a quiet project. And Tuesday I talked about preparing the home for your husband's arrival. Well, you can combine these two things in, for instance, having a quiet activity for your children, which they do the half hour before your husband comes home. And that way you can lower the tenor of the household at 5:30 and 6 and 6:30 and 7 when it's just impossible. The whole situation is just impossible. We have to close down from 5 o'clock and stay closed until 8. But you can combine a quiet activity for them, something that they can do, and you can think of some good things for the children to do that they will not be running around screaming and busy and active and in each other's hair all the time. Just constant noise is not good for anybody, I think. And then I have television. And television is a little bit like Santa Claus. You know, thou shalt not speak evil of dignitaries. You know, there are just some things that you just cannot address yourself to without offending people, and I really don't want to do that. So I say that I found a neat example for my house, a neat way to handle this, and that is the children must ask me before they watch television. It's just that simple. And this has been a simple, good solution for us. Because in that method, we don't have a wild, no, you cannot watch television, you know, that I have to support, that I have to work to keep up. It also reminds me that I'm someone's mother and that I have a job to do over and above the things that I may think are important for that minute. And the catchphrase, go and watch television for a while, is a real, you know, I use it when I have other interests and I don't want people to interfere with my interests. Then the easiest thing in the world to do is say, go and watch TV for a while. And I think you need to look into that situation and see. Also, I had a partner once who taught me that I don't know where I have it in here, but in the notebook I say, oh, truly intelligent people never try to do two things at once. And he always had a lot of funny things that he would say, and that was one of them. And the example he used was walking down the street and listening to a transistor radio at the same time. But that was meaningful to me, and it has been meaningful to me with my children. And I teach them, you cannot do anything well if you do two things at once. So when they're watching television, we don't have a wrestling match. And you can let things get into complete chaos, you see, if you have the television on loud, and you're on the phone, and they're wrestling. It's just madness. So I'm not suggesting that you not let children be children, but that you are alert to total chaos, which need not exist. So we don't wrestle while we watch television. If they are interested enough in the television program to watch it, then they can sit still and watch it. Okay. Now, the next thing is, be sure that the rod is not used in retaliation, in anger. We don't want to retaliate in using the rod. And what happens is, many of you are at your wit's end as you sit here today. You've had it. And so this probably is not the ideal day to start using the rod. On the other hand, one of the assistant ministers at one of the churches where I teach often says that he's going to come in at this point and say, and those of you whose children are causing trouble in the nursery are excused right now to go up there and use the rod and bring them back into control. So some of you need to go home and start today. But if you are deeply emotionally involved with a child, then you'll need to examine this and go back and study this, read the scripture on it, and begin a program of effective training before you begin to retaliate. And once again, it's not for punishment or retaliation, but to train them in the habit of good behavior. Now there's another area that we do not take advantage of enough. And I put the balloons up there because the point of it is if you stick a pin in a balloon, it'll pop. And we do not use natural and logical consequences enough. Now, the example I use is teaching my children to go down the stairs. A lot I had to do was emergency measure. Because if you have a situation I had where the middle one had just barely begun to walk when the third one came, so he still had to be watched, you know, pretty much and supervised, and then David wasn't even three. So I had to use a lot of emergency measures that some mothers don't have to use. And one was going down the stairs. We had a two-story house, and I knew that a gate would do me no good at all. Because I was so frantic that if I had a gate, I'd leave another door open on the other side of the room and they'd just go around that way. You know, I knew that a gate was not going to help me one single bit. So I decided that maybe they could learn to go down the stairs. And I had started this with David when he was little. And I taught him on a little stairway we had that went down like this. And then the landing turned and went across about 8 feet. So there was not a way that you could fall down the whole flight of stairs. But they could fall down those 5 stairs, and it was just, you know, really couldn't hurt them. So I taught them, I showed them how to turn around backwards and climb down, you know, and I would do one leg and then the other, and then the other hand and the other hand, and showed them exactly how to do it 2 or 3 times. And then I let them try it their way, which, of course, is always head first. You know, they just go up the stairs and just go, whoop, right down. And usually they learned in the first day, in the first afternoon, they would learn how to go down the stairs. And they went down always. Now, I don't know. This then they transferred to the playhouse and climbing trees and everything. They really could do that well. Now, I don't know which came first, though. It may be that they were really well coordinated physically, and I took advantage of that. Or it may be that this helped them learn generally, how to climb and how to plan ahead, because it really worked for us. The other thing is ketchup on the food, salt on the food. There are all manner of things, learning about hot. Now, you know, you have 1,000 opportunities to teach a child what hot is by using lukewarm. You know, they respond. If they get the least little lukewarm thing, they say hot. And you can take advantage of that. You can say hot by letting them touch something that's just a little too hot, but not hot enough to hurt them. And I think if we really think in our minds and try to understand the situation in which God wrote His instructions to His people and the kind of society they lived in, and when the child was kept in the home, close to the parents, until they were adults and trained by the parents, you can imagine that they used a lot of natural and logical consequences that we are too organized and too busy to use. It's really a good idea, and there's so many things you can teach them about. We had it at home. We just got putting clothes in the laundry basket was just too much. You know about that. And they were putting their dirty clothes back in the drawer of the clean clothes. So, and by the way, have you ever figured out how the dirt gets in the drawer? I just don't understand how, when I go into my little boy's rooms to vacuum, I have to vacuum out the insides of all the drawers. It's not that way in the little girl's room. I don't understand what they do in there. But anyway, so we had a rule that week that I would only wash the clothes that were in the dirty clothes. And you know what happened for 2 or 3 days. They looked pretty grubby because they just kept putting back on those dirty clothes. But they wear uniforms to school, which helped some because they shortly found they were out of uniforms. Didn't have any uniforms. And sometimes you may have to ask the school to cooperate with you in some of your training projects. But we now have a stack of library books about this high at home. And I have had to ask the school to cooperate with me because I'm not going to think of library books for the next 152 years of my life. They're going to have to figure that out. So there are many, many things that you can do in natural and logical consequences. If you can develop patience and realize that these children are not going to be trained tomorrow, so you may as well use a few of the logical things that you prevent them from getting involved in, that are real learning opportunities. The other thing is private correction. Private correction. Don't correct them in front of their brothers and sisters, because you know why, don't you? They'll say, they will accuse and excuse. They'll say, he hit me first. She hit me first. And it almost doesn't make any difference what the circumstances were. If you begin your correction in public, they will excuse or accuse their own behavior. And you see, we're training not only to have a disciplined, a good child, in quotations, a good child, but we're trying to train them in the principles of godly living. So just as I've tried to train you this week to communicate your needs, not to excuse and accuse other people's behavior, this is part of your training program of the children. You don't want them to accuse or excuse themselves. So you can help train them to do that by having them in a private situation when you correct their behavior. They're not tempted to do it. And then you say to them, what did you do? What did you do? And the principle here is to teach them confession. And we cannot confess anything until we accept responsibility for our own actions. So you want to follow through with this phase. It's very important in training. What did you do? And in the beginning, anything is liable to happen. They'll say, I didn't do anything. Yeah. Or they won't tell you what they did, and you keep going until they do tell you. This is an important area. So be sure that he tells you what he did by, you know, his own responsibility. And I say he must answer this question accurately and fully to learn confession and responsibility. Repeat the correction and repeat the question until he does answer. If he refuses, then you may proceed to use the rod for that disobedience until he does tell you what he did, and then we will go back to the initial problem. The second thing is reflect grief. And this is based on the verse, a child left to himself will bring his mother to grief, or bring his mother to shame. And you want him to see that his behavior affects you. Now, I'm not suggesting that you sit down and cry or have a big hysterical scene at this point. But some often I will say, you know, I'm really grieved in my spirit that that I am going to have to correct your behavior. And I'm so sorry that you and I do not agree and understand on this point yet, or something, you know, so that they see that you are involved in sympathy and compassion and understanding with them. And then you may at that point use the rod. In other words, if you are not using erotic correction in your home, you're still not going to do it after today, then at this point you may involve yourself in another method of discipline. Or you may issue another warning, or you may proceed to use the rod. Now, after, and a rod, again, I don't think I said a few minutes ago, should be a neutral object, a flexible branch, or at least a neutral object. Not something that has to do with your person, or your dress, or something that you do, but as something that's neutral, not connected with you. After you have used the rod, stay with them. Stay with the child, and usually they say stay to restore fellowship, or stay there until they're through crying and there is again an open communication. Now sometimes, it depends on how skillful they are. My little girl says, "Go out of my room now." You know, after I've used the rod, she says, "Leave the room." And I say, "No, I'm not going to leave the room. I'm going to stay with you until you feel better." And she says, "No, I want you to go. I don't want you to be in my room." And I say, "Well, I'm going to stay with you anyway because I love you, and I'm going to stay here until you feel better." And she will stomp around for a few minutes, and then we will have then again a spiritual oneness. You know, and the little ones are so, they really can't understand about the use of the rod. They are really forgiving, and they will just almost immediately renew their spiritual relationship with you after you have spanked them. But it's important that you stay with them at that point until they do. Now, many people say pick the child up on your lap and love them and pat them and all that, but I really don't think it's that necessary. I think that my staying in the room is evidence enough that I love them and I care for them and that I'm going to stay with them. And I don't think that there should be a show of affection which is above and beyond that which there would be in normal situation. So I sit there, I just stay with them. And they'll try all kinds of things to get you to leave, but you just stay there and stay with them. And then the same thing would apply, don't send them out of the room. Then you don't want to send them to their rooms after you've spanked them. But stay with them. Now, the other question that I did not answer earlier is, do you spank for whining? And the answer is yes. I spank for a bad attitude which persists. If they come home from school and they're gnawing on one another and just really, I think, tired, and the competition gets rough, I'm sure, during the day for them, and I will often try to arrange a solo activity and a quiet activity at that time so that they can be separated. Or if it is really bad, I may say, "I want you to go to your room until you feel better. You've had a chance to rest and you feel better." And they'll say, "I don't want to go to my room." And I'll say, "You know, I know, but I'd like you to do this." And then if it persists over several days, then I will talk with the child and say, "You may not share your bitter spirit with our family. And I'm going to help you, because I feel like that your bitter spirit is in control of you, and I'm going to help you get rid of it." And then I help him. I think many, many people who are working to train will tell you that it is really effective, and that God's Word is as consistent and reliable in this area as it is in all other areas. So use the rod, I say, but I have a real understanding, and I myself still fail to do this, and when I do, it's always a mistake. And I usually tell them over and over again, and I have the birthday cake on there to indicate the progress. I often tell them, "I want you to know that I will be faithful to you to correct your behavior so so you can learn to live a full, rich, and productive life. Now, I'll go back to that in a minute. Now, so then you want to know, what do we teach them? How do we know when to spank? And I cannot give you an instant answer for that, but I'm going to go back over the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life principles that I told you I'd cover every day, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And we covered them yesterday and Wednesday, and we're going to go back over them now from a different viewpoint. So they will need to give up in their lives the same thing that parents need to give up. So they will need to give to the Lord their lusts of the flesh and their lusts of the eyes, covetousness, and the pride of life. And so I'll just give you some suggestions in these areas. And here are the three of them now. And I have to look here and see how... I don't have much time to spend on this. Let's see. Okay. Okay, let's go over it this way. The first one over here is controlled by appetites or lust of the flesh. And I'm all twisted up here and I forgot to untwist before I started. So this is lust of the flesh and controlled by appetites. And I really wanted to give you a definition of sensuality today, this week, and I never did get it done. So we'll just have to stick with the short version, which is that all that is not spiritual is sensual, basically. So there are many areas where we're deceived in sensuality and in concentration on ourselves instead of on Christ. Sensual focus, lust of the flesh. And I put up there the favorite lust, everybody's favorite lust. And it's a great big ice cream soda or something, banana split combination, huge thing. And of course that extends into all kinds of fleshly appetites and habits which cannot be broken. Irresponsible eating patterns, giving up future gain for present pleasure. Any of your teenagers do that? they really have irresponsible behavior patterns. And so much of this in teenagers today could be avoided, I think, in the 6 to 12 year age span if you would let them bear the consequences of their own actions. And not having their homework, not leaving their shoes outside. You know, if they have to go to school barefooted a couple of times, they won't do that anymore. They'll begin to remember that. If they have to go to school without a coat on, you know, they might catch a cold. So what? They're going to catch a cold anyway. So you might let them find out early that they are going to be responsible some of these days for what they do. So this is the area of irresponsibility. And I have a little one that just loves to eat, and now you think I'm going to teach a 5-year-old about lust of the flesh? No, I'm not going to. But I'm going to help guide him in responsible living. So many times we think when we hear these principles, well, all right, I'm going to teach my 5-year-old he cannot eat candy all day, and he's going to learn it by the time he's 5 and a half. And that's not it. I said Moses suffered their manners in the wilderness for about the space of 40 years. I didn't say that. Luke said it. But anyway, and I think there are many, many mothers here who might tell you that it takes that long. About the space of 40 years you can plan on training. And then lust of the eyes is next. And that's when we're controlled by our circumstances. That is, and oh boy, you know, are your teenagers ever here? You know, they just rock along through life and the least little thing throws them into a complete emotional turmoil. And you can have a real compassion for this because the next least little thing throws you into an emotional turmoil. So you should be able to see that the control by circumstances with them is just a matter of degrees with many of you. So as you transfer your faith to Christ and learn to trust God for the circumstances, and learn to appropriate His peace, even in bad circumstances, then you can begin to work in compassion and understanding with those teenagers. In the meantime, if you've got little ones, you have a real opportunity to teach them to thank God for the rain on their birthday, and to thank God for losing the soccer game, and begin to develop in them an attitude of reverence for God's sovereignty, and for... you can begin to teach him to let God build new capacities in your life in unpleasant circumstances. And then I have the pride of life. And can you see her up there? I had the worst time finding a picture of the pride of life, and I realized that this one had been sitting right under my nose, and I had missed it. That is a ballerina in her tutu doing an arabesque on top of a circus horse. And it's to represent to us pride over appearance and position. And that's just, again, you can see this in your teenagers. When they are unhappy over the way they look and unhappy over their stature, and they do not want to respond properly to authority. And these are areas that they must learn. And if they don't learn it from you, they're probably going to learn it under more difficult circumstances. So these are things that they're going to have to give up. And we're going to cover these one more time today to try to give you insights in these areas where rebellion against God's principles brings confusion and turmoil into our lives. And I'm going to have to not spend too much more time on them today because we've got two more sections to cover. But the solution to being controlled, of course, by our appearance and our position is to give God His rightful place in our lives. And this is in your notebook in the new me, it's under the abounding, under what? What is it saying? Wait just a minute. Under the sacrificial love of God. So you can restudy the same principle in the new me under the sacrificial love of God and giving God an apple, and He'll give you a new heart. The same principle is covered there. And when the child is controlled by circumstances, they need to learn reverence for God, which would be a thankful trust in God's sovereignty and a willingness to learn. And that's covered in your notebook under the abounding and covering love of God. Abounding and covering love. So it would be under Tree to a vine in the new me, and tower to a rock in the new me. The same chart applies to you and your children and your husband. Now, control by appetites, the solution to that is control by the Holy Spirit. And this is where we really have to feed ourselves with the Word of God until our thoughts and our responses are refocused and we have an understanding of godly living. In your notebook, it's under constraining love, the constraining love of God, and the chart would be from me to a new creation, from me to a new creation. Just to give you some insights on how being controlled by our appetites causes real confusion. And you know, this area, look for a teenager who's driving too fast and irresponsible living. He must be taught that he has to bring himself under the control of God and under responsible living. Now, the most important thing in all of child raising is to reemphasize the principle that training is a yesterday, today, and forever job. And so the verse I used is Deuteronomy 6:5-9. And you know the instructions that Moses gave to Israel, I suppose, have not been as pertinent at any other time in history as they are again to us now. And if you do not know the book of Deuteronomy and the circumstances of that under which that book is written, I suggest you find out and read it, because Deuteronomy means reiteration or restatement. And Moses has just brought the children through 40 years of wilderness wanderings. And if you remember, the children of Israel were in slavery in Egypt. And God delivered them from their slavery, and He brought them to Canaan, which was the promised land of a land flowing with milk and honey. And in Canaan, they were to be His people and to worship Him, and He was going to give them a land where they could live a godly life and a free life. And as He brings them into Canaan, when they finally arrive there and make the passage across, and before His death, He gives them a reiteration, a reminding of the laws of God. And this is in Deuteronomy 6, so you can see he gets to it pretty quickly. And he says, when your children ask you about your heritage, short version, about your heritage, when your children ask you about this land and about the holidays that we observe, you tell them that the Lord your God is a faithful God and that he delivered you from slavery. And he basically says, never let them forget. And oh, our children have forgotten. Our children have forgotten. And Moses tells them, when you get to your land and you prosper with vineyards that you did not plant and wealth that you did not earn, you will forget. You will forget. And our children have forgotten. And so Moses says, here's what you shall teach your children in your land of freedom to worship God. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and upon thy gates. In other words, the principles of godly living are to surround the parents and the home and the family and the business. And then they're to be taught the children day and night by example as well as by doctrine.